The Twin Cities Metropolitan Arts Alliance is a confederation of artists from all of the individual disciplines. The Alliance is a support and resource organization for the local arts community and promotes a healthy arts environment for the metropolitan area. The Alliance also provides an artist services program, which includes job referrals, benefits plans, and other opportunities and programs for Twin City area artists. Earlier this fall, members met at The Place, the downtown Minneapolis club of the Arts Alliance. 8 new members were elected to the 24-member board of directors. At that annual meeting, one of the few times the entire membership gathers together, a 6-person panel pondered the state of the arts in the Twin Cities. We will be hearing from those people this morning. The panel included representatives from theater, music, visual, and the educational fields of the Twin Cities arts scene. The speakers in this order are Sam Sachs, director of the Minneapolis Art Institute, Barbara Fields, literary manager of the Guthrie Theater, Bernie Singer, president of the Minnesota Association of Community Theaters, Don Engel, president of the Minnesota Orchestral Association, Dale Huffington, director of continuing education in the arts at the University of Minnesota, and Bob Lundegaard, arts editor of the Minneapolis Tribune. Now, here is the program moderator, Karen Knudsen, of the Arts Alliance staff.
We all obviously have a commitment to the arts or we wouldn't be here, either professionally or avocationally. And our attention is usually centered on the discipline or the organization that consumes most of our time. We may rarely have a chance to know more about orchestras or sculpture or theaters any more than what we pick up from our entertainment pages in the newspapers. We do feel that one of the primary functions of the Alliance is to be a communication link between the arts themselves as well as with the community at large. And we're fortunate tonight to have 6 guests who are not only forces within the arts in the Twin Cities, but have had considerable experience and contact beyond our immediate area, statewide or regionally or nationally. In the firm belief that what affects any segment of the arts community affects all of us, we've asked each of our guests to speak to us for just a few minutes on the trends and problems and futures that they see in their fields. After our guests have had a chance to make their remarks, we encourage response from within the panel itself, and we invite you to ask questions of or make comments to any particular members of the panel that you'd like to. So at this point, I'll turn the microphone over to our first guest, Sam Sachs.
Thank you, Karen. It appalled me a bit when I saw some of my colleague speakers tonight appearing with prepared remarks. I do not have such because the task was clearly very simple and very finite. We were asked to talk about local, regional, and national problems and their trends, problems, and futures in 5 minutes. That may say something about the state of the arts in the Twin Cities. I'm not exactly sure what. My perspective is one of primarily the local scene, but relating the local scene to the national and indeed the international scene. I thought of a way to sum up what I consider a healthy attitude here and a positive outlook on the future. And I decided that one of the simplest ways, which at least says something to me, is that at long last, the Prairie Home Companion is back on in the morning. That says very good things to me. It makes my outlook a lot brighter. I think if seriously, though, we are to assess the state of the arts and the art of the state, as one of the recent Institute exhibitions was so titled, we have to look at 3 separate categories. One is the hard facts of the financial realities of the arts, both as they relate to the institutions and as they relate to the artists themselves. Second is to the activity within the arts and or the response to them. And finally, and probably most important, the quality of the arts and the quality of the arts institutions. In the area of the financial state, I must say I am moderately optimistic. I see an increasing public awareness of the change that is something we are all living through at the moment, which is the shift from private sponsorship of the arts to a more publicly based sponsorship and indeed consumption of the arts. Similarly, the activity and the response is shifting from a small private base to a broader statewide and indeed you can say regional and national base, and without a loss in quality. It is the loss, however, in quality that concerns me the most, because as one relates to the broad base, it is difficult to maintain what I would at least assume to be a quality stance. And this primarily because the educational system, such as we have all known it, does not include in its primary curricula an arts education. We all are aware that from the earliest ages, we are exposed to and involved in that which is good for us, which includes health and reading and writing and sports. And we see this as a major part of the force in life, and the force in government, and the approach to the quality of our life. If I am worried about anything for our future or our problems or our trends, it is to increase the trend in the inclusion of the arts and the senses in the school curricula and to expose more people on a more widely advertised and consumable base to the arts. I am concerned when I find that in order to have a serious article on the arts published in the media, it is perhaps necessary to submit it first to the New York Times. We are involved in entertainment, to be sure, but we are involved in arts, and we should all press for the maintenance of standards. I think the quality that has been created in Minnesota is something of which we can all justly be proud. And the exposure that this state and its institutions has received in the national media is something quite, indeed, incredible. Some of us are being overwhelmed by requests to find out what we are all about. Perhaps in some quarters, it is good that our own people find out what we are all about.
Thank you. Barbara Field.
Hi. I feel very lucky to be here tonight as representative of maybe two organizations, the Playwrights Lab, which is very small, and the Guthrie, which we know is very large. And it gives me a slightly schizophrenic point of view, and a point of view which is extremely personal, that of the working artist in this community. The myth of Minnesota is that it's very good here for the artist, and I spent a little time away this summer, a month away, working within another artistic community, and during that time I was able to reflect a little bit and make some comparisons with the outside world, which I think is very healthy for all of us to do from time to time. I learned some things while I was gone. I was at the Eugene O'Neill Memorial Theater at the Playwrights Conference. Yes, I was at the Playwrights Conference at the Eugene O'Neill Memorial Theater, and while I was there, I learned that in some respects, we're no better than some of the other communities in this country. There is a great deal of openness which is coming throughout the country for artists to participate and work within a given community. There's also a willingness now to look at anything which is new, which I find very hopeful. There are certain things, however, which I discovered makes Minnesota special for us as working artists. One is its size, which I think to be almost optimum. Another is the distance from other major metropolitan places. In this area, we are able to know each other and to work with each other. In New York City, one only knows the people in one's own field, and there is no possibility for mix. I find the tempo here radically different from most other places. It is a little more leisurely, and there's time for us to reflect on what we're doing and to learn. Comparisons aside, in addition to size and distance, we have one other thing, which is our climate, which I think is something that we should take perhaps more seriously. It is very hard. I think art flourishes in the context of difficulty and hardness, and I think that's been a contributing factor. Maybe winter Walpurgisnachts, when there's nothing else to do, when we can't lie on beaches in California and go out into the streets. There is a tremendous isolation, and this isolation, I feel, has turned us in to each other, and the productive result has been a very interesting body of art and quite different from anything else in the country. I think we have, as a group, and I think particularly because of the Arts Alliance, a unique view of where we are artistically. I think that goes as far as education and politics are concerned as well. And an especially interesting aspect of living in Minnesota as an artist is the willingness of different groups of people to commingle and to share their gifts. That is both at a personal level and an institutional level. For example, the Guthrie Theater, the Minnesota Dance Theater, the Guthrie Theater, the Minnesota Orchestra, and one-to-one happenings and events which have taken part in the city, which I feel very hopeful. I think that the cities have some lacks, and most specifically, I would like to address myself to two of them. One is an occasional feeling that no one is watching us, no one being the people in the big towns. No one is serving as witness to what we do and what we produce. I think that's fine. My feeling is that it's an inferiority complex we will have to get over, no matter what the New York Times prints about us, and that we are going to have to learn that a remarkable body of work can be produced here with its own personality, its own style. The other thing is, very specifically, I feel a lack of a shared space, a performance space, for groups like the Minnesota Dance Theater and the Guild of Performing Arts and the Minnesota Opera. And I think that's one of the problems to which we should address ourselves in the near future. I think it would be very hopeful for us to find a place for these people to work. And that's really all I want to say. It is a good place.
Bernie Singer.
Thank you, Karen. I've had an opportunity to travel the last couple of years to several of our major cities. And as soon as I start mentioning my activity in the arts, I immediately get the reaction, what the hell is happening up there in Minnesota? It reminds me of a joke, which I must tell you, about the fella who was a starving actor looking for a job, and he knocked on agency upon agency in New York City. Finally, one agency felt sorry for him and said, all right, we have a job. You report to the theater on Friday, and they'll give you an assignment. He went down to the theater all excited. They handed him a script with one line. The line was, hark, I hear the cannons roar. They said, read the line. And he said, hark, I hear the cannons roar. They said, no, read it with feeling. He said, hark, I hear the cannons roar. They said, well, that wasn't quite good enough. I tell you what you do. You go home and practice this line for a month. And here's the date of opening night. You don't have to come to rehearsals. Show up at the theater opening night. So he went home and he walked around his house and he walked down the sidewalk. Every place he went, continually rehearsed this one line. Hark, I hear the cannons roar. Showed up at the theater on opening night, checked in at the stage door. They took him down the costume room, put on this huge costume on him. took him upstairs and put him in the wings. He says, what do I do now? They said, practice your line. So he walked up and down in the wings saying, hark, I hear the cannons roar. Hark, I hear the cannons roar. Am I on now? And they said, no, but get ready, it's getting close. So he walked around a little bit more, and all of a sudden somebody grabbed him and said, now, and threw him out on the stage. Just then there was this huge noise. He turned around and said, what the hell was that? That's what this reminds me of. We have just had a roar, I think, in the past couple years up here. And I think we're all taking a long look, saying, what the hell was that that came upon us, and we're in the midst of it now. We have a tiger by the tail. We're very, very well respected in every place in this United States, in all forms of the arts. And I think that could be a very dangerous thing. We draw from at least 5 or 6 surrounding states. We have some large cities in these other states, but they don't have near the arts opportunities that we have in the Twin Cities. We have young persons every day coming to the Twin Cities wanting to participate in all forms of the arts. And I think if you travel in these other cities, just pick up a Sunday newspaper and look at the amusement page. It's the first page I turn to. And I'm amazed to see the lack of opportunities in rather large cities in the surrounding area. I have one criticism of our situation here. I think we continually are all guilty of using the word they. I call it the they syndrome. I did some acting, and whenever the house was empty, the ushers were seating somebody in the middle of the show, they weren't selling tickets. I'm saying they right now. There were no articles in the newspapers. We immediately said, they. Why aren't they doing that? And I think the first thing we must do is remember that they are really we. How many people in this room, maybe you'll raise your hand, have ever heard of or ever gone to the Park Square Theater? Okay. I'm asking a very good crowd, because normally the hand raising isn't quite that high. There's a theater right downtown St. Paul. I'd say a good share of our population walk by it every day and don't even know a theater exists in that building, have never seen some of their fine productions. I'm sure many people in this room have never been to Choreogram, have never been to the Nancy Houser productions. I'm sure if I asked you if you've ever been to Guthrie or Chanhazen, the hands would go up. I think we are as guilty of anybody of staying within our own area of interest and failing to fan out into other areas so that we can all become they instead of we. I also feel that there is a paranoia that exists within all of us in the arts where we do not want to share the talents that we may inherit, a good actor, a good artist, a good grant from some foundation or some private donor, a good director with a lot of talent, especially funding. I think if we find an area that is valuable to our interest, we try to keep it within ourselves. We're afraid to tell anybody because we're afraid they'll steal it from us. And I think if we find that, if we share some of these interests, it won't hurt any of us, and it will probably make us all better organizations. I think one of the big dangers that we are going to run into because of this boom we're involved in now is a multiplicity of theaters. I'm very active in theaters. Right now, the Minnesota Association of Community Theaters has about 40 theaters, and I get about 2 or 3 requests every week from new groups wanting to form theaters. And I feel that we are almost getting to the saturation point, if we haven't already reached that point, where many of these theaters are, number one, dying because of lack of funding, lack of facilities, or I think the most critical problem of all, lack of quality. I think it's all right to put on a program within your church organization or a school organization. Don't charge admission. And have a good time, read scripts, forget lines. But when you're charging $4, $4.50, $5 for for a person to enter your theater, I think you're obligated to give them a quality production. And I think by diluting the talents in this area and every five or six people wanting to form a new theater, I think we're creating a problem here which may eventually reflect on this fine talent that we have in this area. I'm an attorney and I have a habit of talking too long. I'll just summarize what I've said in looking towards the future of the arts in this area. Number one, I think we should definitely have more what I would call cross-fraternization between arts organizations. Let's present dance recitals in our theaters. Let's have art shows in our lobbies. Let's work together instead of staying within our own little shell. Let's all definitely work towards getting more adequate funding. There's no reason in the world why we should be, I hate to use the word ransom, but a ransom organization to the construction of a major sports arena. I think we can stand on our own two feet, and I think we definitely have to approach the legislature this year and see that funding becomes a minor problem rather than one of our major problems. And third, I think we should always strive for quality in our productions. Never lose interest in that. Thank you.
Thank you, Bernie. Don Engel.
I'm one of the people that appalled Dr. Sachs by having written out some things I'd like to say to you. It's not because I don't prefer to wing it, and usually that's the way I do, but it's one assurance of discipline that I'll stay within the time limits that we're given and that we can be sure of getting on with the program. It really is an unusual opportunity to share with you tonight some aspects of the arts of our choosing, since the invitation from Karen said you can talk about whatever you wish within the guidelines that Sam indicated. And while I could talk about music, which I think is a definite minority among all of you theater people here, and visual artists, I leave that to Dennis Rooney with our concerts, or Lee Kamen and his broadcasts on jazz and so on. It seems inevitable that we talk about money when we get together here. That seems to be one of the measurements of the intangibles of the art. We can't really measure what the art experience is in a way that some of the people we'd like to have understand could understand, so we resort to a numbers game and talk about audiences, or we talk about quantity, or we talk about dollars, or something like that, which really is the kind of stand-in for that indefinite something that attracts us to the arts. So I'm going to talk about briefly about an experience in the national scene, because I assume that my colleagues here would probably direct their comments more to our local and state affairs. I'd like to tell you in a few moments at my disposal here of some national efforts to increase public support for arts organizations and for artists through the National Endowment for the Arts. Now, if the National Endowment is not a household word to some of you, it perhaps is reasonable to explain that it's a federal agency, a grant-making agency with money for arts and for artists and for arts organizations. It happens that over some period of years, I served on the music panel, both as a member and chairman. The group that helps the National Endowment decide on the grants that it will make in the field of music. And I have a peculiar arrangement as a consultant now for members of the staff. They don't ask me to consult on anything with them, but anyhow, I get a piece of paper once a year that I'm supposed to sign that says I'm a consultant. Well, it also happens that I'm chairman of what is called the National Committee for Symphony Orchestra Support, which is composed of several presidents and managers of symphony orchestras throughout the country. Now, our purpose is to enlist the nation's symphony orchestras in persuading the Congress to increase its funding for the National Endowment, and in turn, to increase the endowment staff to give more money to orchestras. That, in other words, is a lobbying job. I'm told by the lawyer that represents our committee in Washington that we shouldn't use the word lobbying. Apparently that's frowned upon in some circles. But if we call it legislative education, legislative activity, legislative persuasion, or some other euphemism like that, you know what I'm talking about. Our organization is what's called a 501c4 organization. Those of you that know about all this IRS terminology might realize that that is a tax-exempt organization that is permitted to lobby without restrictions, which all of us nonprofit organizations have to face. In other words, the Minnesota Orchestra or the Orchestral Association can only do any lobbying for the state legislature or the federal Congress on a very limited basis, but our committee is not restricted because we're organized under a different plan. Well, what does such a committee do, and what benefit is that to those of us here? One of the benefits of the National Endowment is not only the grants to major organizations, and some here in the Twin Cities receive funds directly from the endowment, but also to the state arts councils. Now, those of you who are affiliated with some of our smaller organizations do receive federal dollars through the State Arts Board, because every arts council in the country receives an equal amount of money from the National Endowment each year by statute. In other words, the endowment has to appropriate 20% of its federal dollars received to state arts council. So some of that filters in to the state here in addition to our own legislative dollars from the state of Minnesota. One of the smart things our committee did was to find an executive director named Gretchen Ralph, who was at one time president of the Syracuse Symphony and who was a prime mover in the state of New York in the citizens movement that resulted in that fantastic appropriation to the State Arts Council in New York of $34 million a couple of years ago. That's a sum that boggles the imagination here when our State Arts Council is rather well below the $1 million level from our state sources. Well, what does this committee do and how does it relate to what's going on here? As a lobbying group, one of our functions is to line up people in the communities where we have symphony orchestras, and there are something like 1,400 symphony orchestras in this country that are identified as formal structures, although they're not all professional ones, so that when the congressional subcommittees that have to do with appropriations for the endowment are meeting, we have representatives from the areas in which those representatives come. We have symphony orchestra people who can contact the members of those subcommittees and get them to vote right as far as dollars for the arts are concerned. Straight lobbying. One of the things right now that our committee is concerned with, and Mrs. Ralph is involved in, is getting the presidential and vice presidential candidates to define their positions on the arts. And as they are out on the campaign trail, we've had symphony patrons, board members, women's committee members in the audiences for these candidates raising the questions publicly, what is your position on funding for the arts? Would you support an appropriation of $137 million for the National Endowment, which the Congress has authorized? At private parties, we've also had people there who are raising the question to our candidates on the campaign trail, what is your position on the arts? Well, now, maybe this seems like a small issue when we have so many other big things that are occupying their attention. Unfortunately, we're not hearing the debate tonight to know how big the attention is between the two major candidates, at least. But anyhow, after a while, they get the message that there are people in the country that are interested in the arts. And that's a significant thing. I've been in Washington on various occasions to testify on behalf of the endowment before some of the subcommittees that are considering endowment appropriations. And the chairman of these committees have said to us either rather obliquely or very directly, look, you folks who come here asking for money for the arts really don't have your act together. You haven't defined what you need and why. You haven't given us enough hard facts so that we can go to the full Congress or the full Senate and be a spokesman in your behalf. We have a lot of work to do, my friends, in creating an assurance in the eyes of our national legislators as well as our state representatives that there, in fact, is a constituency of people who are interested in the arts in this country and who see that they are a significant part of the social fabric of our nation. This is the function of this particular committee, which, however it may be directed toward concern for symphony orchestras, is attempting to do something on behalf of all arts organizations and artists by calling attention to the fact that there are many, many people, a very substantial part of our population, who are significantly and directly involved with the arts. We're all representatives of that constituency right here tonight, or we wouldn't be here. Well, this is related to what goes on here in the state in various ways. And I have just a second or two to call this to your attention so that there seems to be some relative reason for commenting about this national effort here. We have found that one of the first steps toward getting funding for the arts on the national scale is to get the president to include a recommendation in his budget message to the Congress. If he does so, then the Congress can follow in recommending or at least considering an appropriation up to the level the president has set. We have exactly the same here with Governor Anderson. When he puts together his budget message, whatever he says in that about the arts will be a kind of a guideline for our state legislature when it meets later, and when has been indicated, if we're not tied to a stadium, we will have a chance to make a statement on our own for arts support in the state. We found that the large support of grassroots organizations, and the Arts Alliance here could be one, is essential to convince legislators that there are people really interested. I remember in one of the testimonies we were talking about the amount of money needed by the arts, and one of the congressmen said, well, when we have the Pentagon guys up here, we ask them to round up the numbers to the nearest $5 million. And I thought, goodness sakes, $5 million of rounding up would take care of all the arts organizations in the state of Minnesota and still have a little bit left over. So that's the magnitude of the mentality we're dealing with when we're talking on the national level. Kind of a fascinating experience. Well, the message to you in this is that we are really at ground zero in the whole effort of attempting to get public support for the things that we believe in. Yesterday, I heard somebody say to a bunch of us arts administrators, this is a new ball game for you folks. And I thought, isn't it interesting that the euphemism of a ball game relies on the sports instead of somebody saying, this is a new player, this is a new show, or this is a new concert that you folks are in, this dealing with public agencies. Well, whatever it is, we're all going to need your support, and we're all going to need it together. So we'll be calling on you, knocking on the door, about the time the legislature gets together again. And hopefully, as I said, we'll be there with a statement of our own, and we won't need the sports to help us this time. Thank you.
Thank you. Dale Huffington.
Half of this is the paper I picked up tonight, Sam. I'd like to go from the national back to the local, but starting from the same point. Statistics from the United States Office of Education this fall show that enrollments in arts classes across the nation have gone up over last year. There's certainly a strong plus for the arts, or so it would seem. At the same time, we're all very much aware that the local school population is decreasing, budgets are being cut, and arts programs are in danger of getting the axe. Because of this, it becomes very important for those of us concerned with the arts to provide strong support in the schools, to emphasize their value as an important academic discipline in the regular curriculum, as well as one of those fringe benefits that happens after school sometimes if the English teacher doesn't have too many themes. It's also important to help children understand and appreciate the culture that they live in, that we all live in. We need to be very vocal about this, I think. And it means, as Don has said, everybody who has a chance to say something, taking that opportunity. We need to recognize, in addition, the good programs that exist now, because some of those aren't getting the kinds of support that we all want for them. Urban arts, for example, young audiences, artists in residence. And we need to look for ways that community arts organizations can offer their resources to the schools, with the idea, of course, that there's some mutual benefit coming both ways. The Minneapolis Civic Orchestra has been having a rough time finding an adequate rehearsal and performance space. So they're now talking with the school district about the possibility of having rehearsals and performances in return for providing some special programs to that school. Community Theater in Cedar Rapids, Iowa has done the same thing, but taken it just a little bit further. School district, even in this case, agreed to provide accounting services, health insurance, and some other special fringe benefits. That's quite a plus in anybody's budget. With thought and planning, much could certainly be done by each one of us in facing the particular problems that we have in putting this kind of cooperative sharing and vocal support together. It would bring the arts to a broader segment of our own population and would probably help us to have a better living as well. We have to be concerned, too, I think, with public relations. Getting the word out to the general public. Without this broad support, individual artists can't thrive. In our area, as everyone has pointed out the arts activity has mushroomed. I'm impressed looking at the newspaper with the numbers of things that I can't possibly see each week. That's pretty good. But there's a corollary side to that. More craftsmen and artists are displaying and selling their work at art fairs. More community theaters are hunting for an audience. More experimental theaters are dying for lack of audiences, putting their lives on the line and working without pay and scrounging facilities, just food to put on the table. Competition has increased, and the result is that sometimes the buyers prefer that which is easy, that which is most accessible. In the case of craftspeople, that which is cheap rather than perhaps good. Maybe this means that artists of all kinds are going to have to take more time off from creative activities and learn some techniques in dealing with buyers, with street fair entrepreneurs, club managers, and the public in order to promote themselves and their artistry. This certainly could be viewed as an obstacle and perhaps a very distasteful exercise, but it should be seen as an opportunity. The opening up of avenues of communication between artists and their public can mean easier and less threatening access to the arts for the public. I was amazed to discover that there are people who are scared to go to the Guthrie. But it's true, it exists for everyone. And I'm sure that you sometimes find that at the orchestra. Therefore, we could create, or at least help to create, a more hospitable atmosphere for artists and the public. But how can one individual, artist, or craftsperson, or theater person, or musician, do this? It isn't practical or possible. So, as Don has suggested, there's a very happy kind of thing occurring right here in the Twin Cities. Out of a former attitude of much competition and very little cooperation, artists and craftspeople, arts teachers, non-professional actors, musicians are now beginning to organize and share more and more, in my immediate experience at least. This meeting is obvious testimony to the fact that it's happening. And I don't know why it took us so long. James C. Petrillo showed us all a long time ago what it means when we really got our act together. Some artists feel, however, that an organization will stifle creativity. But others have been won over to the idea that the benefits of shared experience and ideas and the feelings of support from fellow artists are really a good thing to have. It seems to me that out of this kind of cooperation can come a very real forward motion in the arts that can take us over this sort of stasis at the peak we seem to feel we might be reaching and carry forward on a very practical and long-term basis the kind of momentum we have up here in the North Country. The formation of the Minneapolis Arts Commission and the State Arts Board is a very exciting thing. I'm hopeful we'll see some concrete progress next year in a variety of areas. For example, the development of clear, realistic guidelines for artists in the schools so that both the artist and the school can expect something quite reasonable and have a much more satisfactory experience out of it. That visual artists can be given the kinds of help they desperately need to deal with those street fairs and the buyers. But it doesn't have to stop with these specifics. There are many more problems that we have to deal with, many solutions to be found, many ideas shared, as cooperation for quality and standards in the arts provides us with the opportunity to develop a public-spirited arts community. Thanks.
That was Dale Huffington, Director of Continuing Education in the Arts at the University of Minnesota. He concludes the presentations by members of the arts community. Now, words from an arts observer, Bob Lundegaard of the Minneapolis Tribune.
I'm a little different from Dale. When he looks at the newspaper, he's impressed with all the things he isn't able to see that week. I'm impressed with all the things we couldn't print that week. Because from my standpoint, the arts community is really a sort of a sea of raised hands, everybody saying, me, please notice me, give me a little attention. And that's certainly very understandable. As far as this subject tonight, I think I'll cut back my time a little bit to get us back to our average of 7 minutes before we all turn into pumpkins. I feel a little like someone who's writing a letter to someone he hasn't seen for 20 years. He really hardly knows where to begin. But I think the best way to do it is to share with you a couple of experiences I had the last few nights, which I think lead to a generalization. One of them was attending my high school son's open house last night. The first class that we sat in was his English class, and the teacher announced that the first thing he'd had the students do on the first day of class was to sit down and write a poem without any indication of what they were to say. It's certainly an exciting and an energetic concept of the arts, but as far as I know, what resulted were 30 terrible poems. I'm not really too clear on what did result, except that the teacher appeared terribly interested, terribly concerned, and terribly energetic. And I was reminded of that because I had lunch today with some people who are about to start a new weekly newspaper in Minneapolis, one of many, that still one more, that have been tried. And this one looks kind of interesting, and the theme that they're selling to advertisers is that Minneapolis is more exciting than its journalism, which naturally hits home a little bit. That's all right, no, I agree. I sometimes said that Thief River Falls is more exciting than Minneapolis journalism, but that they begin by saying that Minneapolis is a city of political energy and cultural sophistication. And I suggested to them, with some agreement on their part, that perhaps they had the adjectives wrong, that our political energy is fantastic, especially the way we seem to send people on from local government into the national government, but that our culture is really more energetic than sophisticated. And certainly I feel that way from the areas that I have something to do with in terms of reviewing, which really haven't been touched on tonight, namely films and television. Films, I think a good example is that at long last, I think about a year after New York saw Ingmar Bergman's Face to Face, Minneapolis, the citadel of Scandinavian culture, is at long last going to be allowed to see this movie, which we've all been reading about in national magazines for a year. And if we're really as sophisticated as a lot of people think we are, I'm just not clear why we shouldn't be seeing movies like this on a regular basis and seeing them as soon as New York and Los Angeles and Chicago and Washington and Boston see them. And as far as television goes, obviously our national television is pretty much what, the television that we get on the networks is pretty much what all the other cities get. Our public television, I think, especially considering the resources of our artistic community, which have been touched on here tonight, are a disgrace. And I think at long last, perhaps that is going to turn around. I hope so, if everybody isn't completely turned off by the severance settlement with Dr. Schwarzwalder. But I would just like to suggest that on the basis of the two areas that I'm most familiar with, the movies and the public television, that I don't think we have a right to be too smug. I think we really do have a long way to go. Thank you very much.
That was Bob Lundegaard, arts editor of the Minneapolis Tribune. Following the formal part of the program, I spoke with Bernie Singer, president of the Minnesota Association of Community Theaters. Singer fears that this area may be saturated with local theater.
Well, firstly, I feel that there's only a certain core of actors to go around, and as you increase the amount of theaters, you're diluting the amount of quality actors that are available for any given theater. So ultimately, you're going to end up with less than good quality productions. Secondly, there is a certain maximum audience that will attend legitimate theater in the Twin Cities, and the more theaters we add, the smaller the audiences are diluted amongst all of them. I might add that the increase in theaters seems to be more in the outlying areas, the suburban areas, and then the smaller cities around the state. In that instance, it's healthy.
Because there aren't presently enough theaters operating in those areas now?
Right. There aren't any in most areas that are starting up.
Do you sense that the public is inundated with these theaters? They're seeing them spring up in all kinds of productions when they open up their entertainment pages of the newspapers and the community papers, and that they might be growing weary of it or not knowing how to make selections and consequently turning off to the community theater? Is it having this adverse effect yet?
I don't feel that they've actually turned on 100%. I feel our theater-going public in the cities are still accustomed to going to the Guthrie and the Old Log and Chanhazen. And any theater beyond those three is a giant step. I was talking to a high school drama teacher from a small city right outside the cities who brings classes in to theater, and he says, we always bring them to the Guthrie or Chanhazen. And I said, why don't you bring them to a good community theater production? He says, well, we're afraid. I think that answers it in a nutshell. They're afraid to take that giant step. There's excellent community theater, and somehow we have to get the message to the public that it exists. It exists within blocks of their homes, and they're unaware of it.
How does your office go about spreading the message of community theater?
Well, we primarily do what I call missionary work. We form theater-going parties, number one, and have special nights at community theaters and try to bring friends of ours who have never been in a community theater or a particular community theater to these theaters. We also put out a newsletter once every 2 months with reviews, stories about what's going on at the other theaters. And then we encourage our local newspaper and television radio people to try to spread the word about some of these smaller theaters that are putting on some quality productions.
You also touched on another interesting point, and that is that artists should generate some of the excitement for each other, should be supporting each other's works and attending each other's plays. How important is this to generating community enthusiasm within the arts community and outside of it?
Well, I think it's only important in that every artist has a circle of friends, and if he stays at one given theater, his circle of friends are going to stay close to him. If he goes to other theaters, he encourages his friends to go to other theaters, we are going to get this cross-fraternization that I was referring to earlier.
Are we too smug about our theater here? You've been to other parts of the country and observed other theater. Is it as healthy and as vibrant and as innovative as sometimes we read about it in our own newspapers and in some cases in national magazines that compliment the area?
It's healthy and it's vibrant. I don't think we're smug yet, but I think we're approaching that danger point. That's what I'm afraid of. Last summer I was in California, with the theater group at the ATA convention, and we went to the Old Globe Theater in San Diego, which is the leading Shakespearean theater on the West Coast. Half of our theater group, composed of very theater-knowledgeable persons from the cities, walked out at intermission because the quality was so poor. We went to 5 community theaters between San Diego and Los Angeles, and there wasn't one production that even approached the quality of our Twin Cities theaters.
Bernie Singer, president of the Minnesota Association of Community Theaters. I spoke with Singer at the annual meeting of the Twin Cities Metropolitan Arts Alliance in Minneapolis. I'm Neil St. Anthony.